Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last Saturday, after almost 2 weeks of speeches and intense negotiations, delegates from 196 countries came together for the very first time to tackle climate change by limiting greenhouse gas emissions. The key measures stipulated in the Landmark Pact include a pledge to keep global temperature increases to well below 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, to review progress every 5 years, and to provide $100 billion a year in climate financing for developing countries by 2020. Even though the Paris Agreement has been hailed as a positive and serious first step to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in an effort to slow climate change, some environmental activists question the effectiveness of the accord in doing that. Former NASA scientist and prominent environmental activist James Hansen said the agreement is a fraud. In an interview with The Guardian of London, he said, quote, "We'll have a 2 degrees Celsius warming target and then try to do a little better every 5 years. It's just worthless words. There is no action, just promises. As long as fossil fuels appear to be the cheapest fuels out there, they will be continued to be burned," end quote. But many scientists who have analyzed the deal say it will cut global greenhouse gas emissions by about half of what is necessary to stave off an increase in atmospheric temperatures. So what are the pros and cons of the climate agreement, and what will it accomplish in the short run and in the future? On today's Your Call, we are joined by two guests who just returned from Paris. Mark Jacobson is professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of atmosphere and energy program at Stanford University. He's co-founder of the Solutions Project, a nonprofit whose mission is to use the powerful combination of science and business to accelerate the transition to 100% clean, renewable energy. And Mark joins us from Stanford. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Mark Shapiro, a longtime environmental journalist and author of Carbon Shock, a tale of risk and calculus on the front lines of a disrupted global economy. Mark was in Paris covering the climate summit as an editor with the Internet Environmental Reporting Network. He also covered it for Newsweek. Mark is also a lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, and he joins me in studio. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
It's great to have you. So thank you both for joining us. So the big news coming out of Paris is that for the very first time, 196 countries came together to tackle climate change by saying that they will limit greenhouse gas emissions. Mark Shapiro, how big of a deal is that?
I think it is actually a very big deal. And we can get into the kind of exact details of what was agreed upon, but let's remember that for the first time in history, you have the creation of a new structure to deal with, number one, communication between developed and developing countries, a whole new kind of forum by which that is happening, a body of agreements. We know they're not legally binding, but a body of agreements to actually begin the process of reducing greenhouse gases, and most significantly, an extraordinary consensus. Remember, nothing happens at the UN without every single country voting for it. So an extraordinary consensus on the reduction of our reliance on fossil fuels to deal with climate change. So whatever we talk about when we talk about the details of this measure, I think we need to keep that in mind, that we have an entirely new framework emerging.
Because at past conferences, this never happened, where you had 196 countries come together and agree on something.
Right. I mean, basically, and in the even in the Kyoto Protocol days, which was, God, 25 years ago or something, you had nowhere near this level of consensus. And I would also add to that, you have an emerging, you have changes happening within the business community in terms of their attention to, number one, the huge possibilities of green energy, shifts from fossil fuel investments amounting to the hundreds of billions of dollars away from fossil fuels, many of the leading financial institutions of the world beginning to see the true financial risks from climate change. So this kind of combination of one enormous understanding by the business community of the effects of climate change, two, growing understanding by businesses, and three, governments, And three is the emergence of an unprecedented transnational popular movement that has never existed in the world on this scale before.
Right, and we will talk about the activists who are mostly outside of the conference. Those who did get in got arrested. But before we do that, Mark Jacobson, what are your thoughts on the fact that for the first time, 196 countries came together to agree to a deal?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing to have all these countries agree on the same thing. Certainly, the actual agreement itself doesn't bind countries legally, but as was mentioned, there's this popular movement behind it, and I think a lot will actually happen in many of these countries that are a lot further than what is actually agreed to. Take the United States, for example. I mean, when I talk about popular movement, there's really a popular movement not only to reduce emissions, but really to eliminate fossil fuels entirely and to go to 100% clean renewable energy. This was really the mantra behind a lot of the people, tens of thousands of people who went to Paris. Most of them are talking about going really all the way to 100% clean renewable energy, and that's actually, in the United States, that's actually taking hold even to a greater degree. Just last week or week and a half ago, H.R. House of Representatives Bill 540 actually proposed that the United States go to 100% clean renewable energy by 2050, and all three presidential candidates on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley, have all committed publicly for the United States to go to 100% clean renewable energy by 2050. And two states, California and New York, have already adopted laws to go 50% clean renewable energy by 2030, and Hawaii in the electricity sector alone is going 100% by 2045. So there's already this movement, not only in the U.S., but worldwide, and so the agreement itself is actually more modest than what a lot of people are thinking. And it, as mentioned also, businesses, they're most of the top businesses in the world are actually have a goal now to go to 100% clean renewable energy, and at least 96 cities around the world have 100% clean renewable energy goals also.
Well, you mentioned business, Mark Shapiro, well, both of you, and I think this lead from a recent Market Watch piece says it all. It says, as if it couldn't get any worse for oil companies, the historic climate change deal agreed in Paris is seen as another nail in the coffin for future demand for fossil fuels. This is according to a Morgan Stanley analyst note.
Yes, and thank you for bringing that up, Rose. And I wrote about this from there for Newsweek, and I've written about this elsewhere, this phenomenon where some of the largest financial institutions in the world, which have been weighing in on the financial realities of climate change. So you have some of the banks, which I'm sure you've actually had criticized here in this very studio, Rose, from Citibank to Goldman Sachs, some of the titans of the global economy. Just put them, let's think of them as sources, though, for the moment, as to their understanding of what climate change means for the global economy. And what's actually very interesting is to read the reports coming out of Goldman Sachs, coming out of Citibank, coming out, like you said, of Morgan Stanley, coming out of the major credit agencies, Standard & Poor's and other ones, which are talking about the perilous nature of investments in fossil fuels due largely to the significant shifts, number one, of the world's sensibility away from fossil fuels to the rise of new technologies that are using energy far more efficiently and the movement towards a price for carbon. And so I think this represents a hugely significant development. And what was interesting is I wrote about this from Paris just a couple days ago, about 4 or 5 days ago, of how the Financial Stability Board, okay, who's ever heard of the Financial Stability Board? Well, you know, we should actually just be somewhat aware of this kind of very technical term. After the financial collapse of 2011, the G20 countries, which, of course, are the most wealthy countries in the world, decided that they wanted to avoid more kind of instability from kind of unseen risks in the economic order, which in that time was derivatives and housing, the housing blow-up. And so they set up this thing called the Financial Stability Board to identify future risks coming down the line. And what have they identified now? They've actually requested that all the major economies, members of the G20, including the United States, of course, begin to do a stress test on the risks from climate change to the financial institutions of this country and of the world. And that effort is led by the head of the Bank of England, which is much like the Federal Reserve Board in the UK, and by Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York, who knows something about money. So there are enormous shifts happening in the financial system as well.
Mark Jacobson, what are your thoughts on that? Because the rallying cry from activists this year, and it has really caught on, is keep it in the ground, right? Keep fossil fuels in the ground and embrace renewable energy. And it's really important to talk about this angle of the deal, because the banks are involved in this, the oil companies are involved in this, and then, of course, we talked about this on last week's show about climate change. They're giving money to politicians who also make decisions about whether to invest in more nuclear technology, for example, or renewable energy. What really strikes you about the differences and the changes that you're seeing, for example, in this analyst note that we're reading from Morgan Stanley?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of changes going on right now, and I think the key is that we need to focus on transitioning to clean renewable energy. And so there's going to be a lot of distractions about, well, what are the solutions? And so there will be some distraction. People are talking about nuclear power, but which is a technology really that's dead in the water, and it will only delay a solution to the problem. And I say that factually, not just out of just for saying it. For example, the cost of nuclear power is, the levelized cost is 12.5 cents per kilowatt hour, compared to wind in the United States is about 3.2 to 5 cents per kilowatt hour onshore. Solar power at the utility scale is on the order of 5 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour. So both of those are half to a third or more the cost of nuclear. So that'll never go. And so, but there's a lot of talk about, well, how do you solve this problem? And part of the solutions, people are talking about nuclear, but and it's not only the cost issue, but also the fact that it also does result in some emissions of carbon, because you have to mine and refine uranium, which there are two coal-fired power plants whose sole purpose is to do that in the United States for weapons and energy. And it takes so long to put up nuclear, 10 to 19 years, compared to 2 to 5 years for wind and solar, that while you're waiting around, you're running the regular fossil grid. People are also talking about coal with carbon capture, trying to keep the coal industry in business. But that's a technology that doesn't exist at any commercial scale, and it may never exist at a commercial scale. But it also is very costly, and it results in 25% more coal use, which means all the other pollutants aside from carbon dioxide get emitted. You have 25% more of those emissions. And so it's really a more dirty technology in terms of air pollution, even though it reduces carbon, but it still only reduces carbon down to so it's still 60 times higher than wind power per unit energy. So we have to be really careful about the technologies we focus on, and to try to transition not only transitioning the actual technologies, but also transitioning jobs. We find that we would create about 22 million jobs worldwide net over lost by transitioning to clean renewable energy. But this requires kind of a concerted effort to do this. But if we don't actually transition, if we keep the same status quo and keep emitting as we're doing, we're going to essentially lose 22 million net jobs. So maybe I'll stop there for now.
That is Mark Jacobson. He is professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford University. He's co-founder of the Solutions Project, and I hope you look this up online. It's thesolutionsproject.org. The world can transition to 100% clean, renewable energy, and it's a really nice website, very easy to navigate. In fact, if you have family members over the holidays who think this is not possible, this is a really good website to point them to, because it's very easy to understand. We're also joined by Mark Shapiro, longtime environmental journalist and author of Carbon Shock, A Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of a Disrupted Global Economy. Mark was in Paris covering the climate summit, and we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this deal? What questions do you have based on what you've heard? What are the pros and cons? At the end of the day, the goal is to keep fossil fuels in the ground and embrace renewable energy. So what questions do you have about that? What's happening in your area? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's talk a little bit about the United States, and then we'll talk about other countries, specifically poor countries. So the key measure, again, was a pledge to keep temperature increases to well below 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And Mark Shapiro, Mark Jacobson was just talking about the fact that we have to be very careful about what renewables we embrace. And I'm wondering, when you look at the federal government's role in the United States, how important is the money that is spent on research? Because the National Priorities Project just came out looking at the 2015 budget and found that the big losers were renewable energy and the environment. So President Obama, for example, wanted a decrease in fossil fuel energy research. Instead, lawmakers gave fossil fuel research a boost, $571 million. Obama also wanted a decrease in nuclear energy research. Congress did the exact opposite. Obama wanted more for renewable energy research. Congress did the opposite, right? So for renewables, it was $380 million versus $571 for fossil fuel. And the renewable research was 16% less than Obama wanted and the other Democrats.
Yes. I think this is obviously a symptom of this kind of dysfunctional political situation we have here in this country. And it's particularly outrageous when you, we're dealing with climate change created by fossil fuels. And yes, this country has been providing billions of dollars every year in subsidies to the fossil fuel industries, literally creating, providing billions of dollars in tax breaks and direct subsidies to oil and gas companies, which then result in higher and higher expenditures on the American taxpayer to deal with the consequences of climate change. So it's the ultimate kind of completely illogical lunacy. I mean, basically, you're spending money to create the need to spend more taxpayer money, if you just look at it financially. And so there have been efforts for years by President Obama. Actually, President Obama, I think pretty much practically every year, has attempted to reduce the fossil fuel subsidies every time he comes up against the fossil fuel industry, which, as we know, is enormously influential in the American political system. And I think that that is a the fact that we're losing renewable energy subsidies is really a symptom of the enormous influence that continues of the fossil fuel industry on this country. And what's interesting about renewable energy subsidies, the need for subsidies, because the fact is you need this subsidization to kickstart, to get onto a massive scale, new large-scale renewable energy projects, as well as to develop further research on storage capacity and other things that are very important to the future of solar and wind. And what's happened every time those subsidies have been provided is that the price comes down and they become directly competitive with fossil fuels. And that is obviously something the fossil fuel industry is trying to avoid.
And that is what China is doing, right?
Yes.
It's providing major subsidies. And as a result, they are the biggest users of wind and solar.
Yes. And I think that that is one of the most significant and interesting developments in Paris, and you couldn't help but pick it up. It was fascinating to watch, and I was in Copenhagen, for example, the last great big climate negotiations in 2009. And at that time, the big evil force when it came to greenhouse gases was China, and everybody was ganging up on China as the main source of emissions, and they had to act, and they were blocking the moves forward. Completely different this time around. Chinese government, as you mentioned, has been moving forward very aggressively with renewable energy. They're now the biggest producer of solar technology in the world, outcompeting American companies for whom the subsidies have been withdrawn. is also moving aggressively to decarbonize their grid. Now, it's not going to happen overnight. They still use a huge amount of coal. But I think there was widespread acknowledgement that China, from having been the laggard in these negotiations, was actually very much moving forward in a more renewable energy direction. And that's been one of the most significant changes of the dynamic there. I would add one other significant change just to acknowledge, which is that the United States was a real player this time around. The United States was a real player this time around, and it was because of the moves that President Obama had made within the constraints of the system that he has, which are severe, to move the United States forward when it comes to development of green energy and to diminish the impact of coal through the Clean Power Plan and other measures.
Can you give us more insight into that, Mark? What went on behind the scenes? What were you hearing from U.S. negotiators? John Kerry was one, but we hear delegate negotiator. Who are these people?
Well, I'm not sure I can offer like specific, you know, character portraits of all of them, because a lot of these did take place behind closed doors.
Yeah.
And you didn't really get access to the negotiating sessions, although, you know, there were people crawling all over the place. I mean, I think it was what was interesting was that how aggressive the United States was. Number one, Obama came. The amazing thing about Obama is, and look, I'm perfectly capable and I've written very critically about the current administration on many things. But the very interesting, Obama came to the session on Monday, I believe, the very first day. He gave a speech, and there were two very important things about that speech. The first was that he acknowledged directly the United States culpability for the enormous quantity of greenhouse gases released over the last 200 years of industrialization, and acknowledged explicitly the responsibility that created for countries, the United States and others, wealthier countries, to deal with the consequences to countries that have not contributed much to that problem. One, that was a very important recognition. Mm. The second thing he did was he used this word. My jaw practically dropped when I heard it. This word that is one of those deadly words of economists, but is actually quite loaded with meaning, which is the notion of externalities, which is what this whole business is all about. When you talk about trying to put a price on carbon, trying to reduce the impacts of fossil fuels, you are, in essence, talking about the external costs, the costs borne by society that are not being paid when we purchase fossil fuels. And there was President Obama talking about the need to reduce the externalities from climate change, using the actual word externalities, which is, of course, what my book Carbon Shock is all about, trying to tell the stories behind those externalities. But I was pretty startled to hear President Obama say that. So the United States went in there with a lot more credibility than it had in 2009 after 8 years of President Bush.
And just quickly, before we go to break, James Hansen, former NASA scientist, who for the most part ripped on the deal and said it's worthless words, he says in order to have something strong and meaningful, there has to be a carbon tax.
Yes. Well, that's totally clear. And pretty much every economist across the board agrees that if you're going to really reduce reliance on fossil fuels and shift investments on a massive scale, you actually have to be paying the actual price for carbon and for fossil fuels. And that can be imposed through a tax, which is by far the most direct and most inefficient way. We here in California trying to do it through the cap and trade system. I think it's pretty much acknowledged that, one, it's having kind of some of impact here in California, which, by the way, was a strong presence at the negotiations to some degree. The price, though, is still far below what it is actually costing the society to make this shift.
And James says, let's call it a fee because the word taxes scare people off. And he says that if we did this, it would bring in about $600 billion in the U.S. alone. And we're going to take a quick break, but I'll ask you to comment more after the break. Mark Shapiro is a longtime environmental journalist. He was covering the climate talks in Paris. Mark Jacobson is professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford and runs the website The Solutions Project, which focuses on transitioning to 100% clean, renewable energy. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is always better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also send your email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. As the end of 2015 approaches, we hope you keep KALW in mind when you consider your year-end charitable contributions. When you donate to KALW, you're giving great non-commercial to radio to people all around the Bay Area. More information about your membership at KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we want to hear from you and the documentaries that you loved this year. We're going to talk about some of the best documentaries of the year. We've done a lot of shows on films about the rise of the Black Panther Party, the lives of recyclers in West Oakland. We did a show about the film 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets, which focused on the murder of Jordan Davis, a Black teenager who was playing loud music in a gas station parking lot in Jacksonville, Florida. So many great documentaries are out there. Which ones stood out for you? Which ones inspired you to act? You can email us the info at feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also drop us a line if you have a story idea or a guest idea. Today, we are talking about the deal that came out of Paris. It was an historic deal because for the very first time, 196 countries agreed to keep global temperature increases to well below 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. We'll talk about what that actually means. But the fact that so many countries came together for the first time is a big deal in and of itself. What are your questions about it? What do you want to know about what it will actually take from transition from a fossil fuel world to a world that embraces renewables? We're talking about it today with Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford. He's co-founder of the Solutions Project, a nonprofit whose mission is to transition to 100% clean renewable energy. Mark Shapiro is a longtime environmental journalist and author of Carbon Shock, a tale of risk and calculus on the front lines of a disrupted global economy. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And before we get to calls, Mark, I just wanted to ask you, I read the numbers from the National Priorities Project about funding for fossil fuel energy research, 571, versus funding for renewable energy research, 380 million. How important is this when you talk about the transition?
Well, we're talking about this, Mark.
Mark Jacobson.
Yeah, I think it's not so critical because their technologies, wind and utility-scale solar, are already the cheapest forms of electric power in the United States today. And so they're just by deploying them, their costs are coming down. I mean, research and development will help, but it's not necessary to actually affect the transition. I mean, certainly every bit of research, so I'm not trying to say we shouldn't get more, but it's not like a doom and gloom problem by not having as much as we want. I mean, there's a lot of private money also going into research and development as well.
Okay, well, that's good to know. And then when we're talking about renewables, how do you see this playing out in countries that don't have the funds for subsidies, for example?
Well, that's also, in the long run, it's not an issue because people will save money by transitioning. I mean, you create jobs, and so even though you have to put capital up front, the actual cost of energy in all these countries is less when you change to renewable energy. So people will save money in the long run in every one of these countries, but you do need some capital to actually get it going. But there's also this job creation that occurs, and you also eliminate health and climate problems together. So keep in mind that worldwide there are 4 to 7 million people die each year prematurely from air pollution from fossil fuels and biofuels, and this costs the world 3 to 7% of the GDP. And so when you actually transition to clean renewable energy, you not only save money from the direct business cost of the energy, but you save actually a lot more money. Actually, it's 2 to 3 times that in health costs plus climate costs. And so there's a net benefit not only for job creation, but reducing costs to society, health and climate costs, and you stabilize energy prices for the future, and you make your country more energy independent, so you don't have to rely on importing and fossil fuels, which also brings along with it international conflict. So you reduce international conflict, and you reduce, because you have more decentralized power, there's less risk of terrorism, disruption of the grid, and you bring people out of energy poverty in a lot of these countries. So there's all these reasons for countries to do this, to push towards it, even if they don't have lots of subsidies, because it'll still save them money.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, and we have a caller who has a related question about renewables. Let's go to Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Let me turn off my radio. Yeah, I have a question directly related to that, because while it's true what Mark, I believe, just said, that, you know, there will be job creation, one of the beauties of renewables, which should be encouraged, is that it decentralizes energy. So people can, you know, install things individually and get out from under the power companies, you know, at home, for example. And also that it's more efficient of resources and it's passive. And there will be job creation initially, but then because, you know, these installations just sit there and they're passive, you know, that they don't require ongoing work, I'm kind of worrying about the workers, the people who work now in coal mines, work for power companies, work for petrochemical industries. How will these people be able to continue to earn a living? It's a big quandary, because you always want things to be less you want things less to be made, less consumerist, less, you know, using of resources. But at the same time, you want people to be at least housed and clothed and fed.
Well, Mark Jacobson, you and your team have looked at that.
Yes, yeah, we've looked at that. And so worldwide, we've considered that you'll have a certain fraction of rooftop solar, for example, that'll require less jobs to maintain. But that's only going to be around 15% of total energy worldwide, because you just don't have enough rooftops to actually power. So you will have to have power plants. And there are also other, you need storage facilities, you'll need battery, people to work in batteries and automobiles. We're transitioning not only electric power, but also heating and cooling, industry, transportation, agriculture, forestry, and fishing, all the sectors. So there are all sorts of appliances and technologies that will require jobs. And we find you'll have a net of 22 million 35-year jobs versus lost. And so these coal miners will transition into the clean renewable energy sector.
Mark Shapiro?
Yeah. I would just add something. It's a very good question. I think actually to a great degree now is the time to start thinking of this notion in the kind of talks. It was referred to as the just transition, which was language that was inserted into the preamble of the accord, which essentially in English language means a transition in which those who are displaced by this transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy are provided some kind of assistance. And I think this is very important in this country as well as internationally to think this through. When we think of the transition away from coal or oil, there's no need to have any – we're not talking about having any sympathy for the CEOs of these companies who are going to be doing just fine. The fact is there are hundreds of thousands of people, possibly more, in the United States who do make a living off of working in the fossil fuel industries. They're just trying to make a living, support themselves and their families. And there needs to be some mechanism, and this is what's beginning to actually rise in priority, to assist those people to make this transition. And often – when there is a discussion of a carbon price, for example, it's referenced as something as a tax and dividend. Or in California, even some of the proceeds from the carbon market here in California are channeled into some of the least advantaged communities here in the state of California. And so when we begin to think about a price for carbon, that's a very important part of the picture, and I think is beginning to make its way into the top levels of the international community as well.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Judy. We should do an entire show about that because that's a really important topic. Thank you for that. Let's go next to Ariane in San Francisco. Hi, Ariane. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I just want to remark that when our politicians resist changes because they say it will hurt our economy, that sometimes we fall into the same trap when environmentally and as change promoters, we promote or focus on economic solutions, and that we're like sort of tiptoeing around some of the things that we need to articulate openly, which is that all life is living in a network or a wolf and web of interrelatedness, and that we're living on the lip of extinction when we just disregard the sanctity of life of those things that are different from us. And the second part of this comment is that, you know, when we look at these economic-focused solutions, some of the people who attended the Paris talks and some of the people who focus on those solutions are also compromised by developers as well. So they're trying to profit from the needed changes, and we need to look at that critically. Because, for example, even in the Bay Area, the Oakland mayor, the Oakland City Council, and the Sierra Club are promoting the clear-cutting of the East Bay Hills, 500,000 trees, at a time when we need every tree we can get to fight climate change. And they're doing this in the same ways that we see the larger political arguments where we basically demonize people who are different from us, whether they're Muslims or whether they have different ways of living. So they demonize the eucalyptus. These are the same paradigms that we're fighting for.
Well, Ariane, thank you for calling. Let's get Mark Shapiro to respond first.
Thank you for your call. You've hit quite a bit of huge topics here, Marion. But number one, I do want to tip my hat to your rendering of the Earth and I think it is important to remember that the Earth is a huge organism. We are all mm-hmm. part of this organism, and that organism has been made habitable by the unique conditions of this time period that we are living in, and that is because of the particular balance of gases, really literally, and the mixture of gases in the atmosphere and water that falls from the sky onto the land that makes this particular time period habitable and enable us humans to thrive in this area. And we are now disrupting that balance. That is what climate change is all about. Secondly, I just want to point to a key factor in the accord, which has to do with forests. I'm not totally familiar with the situation in Oakland with the trees, but in the big global scale, of course, the notion of using trees as carbon sinks is extremely important. And really, for the first time, we have some acknowledgement of that in this accord. It may be subject to market forces. It's a whole other show for you probably, Rose, about how that is going to be done. But for the first time, you really have a very explicit acknowledgement of the preservation of forests as carbon sinks. The third part of your you've hit a lot of big topics there, Mary, and I just wanted to address the third question, which is the economic question. First of all, you've identified a key dispute in the discussion, which is if we put a price on carbon, what is that going to do to the economy? Well, I have actually looked. I wrote about this in my book, Carbon Shock, and even since then, and I was asked to testify at a state hearing in Vermont, which is considering the implementation of a carbon tax, and I made it my business to actually study the economic studies that have been done about those jurisdictions that have imposed a price for carbon, either in tax form or a significant market approach. And the interesting thing, and I wanted to challenge myself because I didn't want to get sandbagged by somebody who knew counter information, so I challenged my own assumption that this basic idea of a carbon price could be good for the could at least not damage the economy. And what was interesting is I couldn't find a single study anywhere in the economic literature which suggested that when a jurisdiction, whether a state or a national government, imposed a price on carbon, that it led to a contraction, an economic contraction. In fact, in most cases, it led to an economic expansion. And so I think this is very important to remember when we talk about the notion of a price for carbon. We're talking about an essential huge shift in the way that the economy is organized. The economy is organized now explicitly to favor fossil fuels. And it is not a free market. It's a distortion of the free market, the way it's worked, because essentially the fossil fuel companies make the profits and we, the society, bear the risks. And what we're trying to do is shift that huge economic entity in a new direction towards renewable energy, which in the do not ultimately cost as much.
And Mark Jacobson, do you have anything to add?
Well, if we look at emissions of that are carbon dioxide buildup, most of them are due to fossil fuels, but about 10% is due to land use change, which is primarily permanent deforestation, mostly in tropical regions. And that's been declining, and it's anticipated to decline more, but it's still a major source. And now we can see it locally. When their local forests cut down, that's not good. So, we want to encourage reducing permanent deforestation everywhere. And so that's essentially like reducing fossil fuel emissions. It is the exact same thing, because forests do store a lot of carbon, and when you cut them down, that carbon just goes back into the air.
Right.
And with regard to carbon tax, I think that's just one of many options for addressing it. I actually think that we should set goals of, what percent renewables, like if we want to go to 80% renewables by 2030 or 100% by 2050, then each state or country or jurisdiction will then have to determine the best way to accomplish that goal. The problem of just specifying one policy mechanism as opposed to a bunch is that, first of all, just something like a carbon tax, it could actually result in more air pollution. For example, it could encourage coal with carbon capture and sequestration, even though it doesn't exist at the commercial scale. It's something that, people can push for, and if it does exist, what that does is it does reduce carbon, but it does not actually reduce any other pollution from coal. It actually increases it all 25% because you need 25% more coal. So you can have, bad impacts, whereas if you actually say we want to, you can either, ratchet down emissions from certain sources, or you can just transition those sources into clean producing sources entirely. And so that's really the goal, is to go to clean renewable energy. So we should just say that up front, that we want to go to eventually 100% clean renewable energy, and then let each jurisdiction figure out what's the best way to get there. Because otherwise we could just end up not even solving one problem, but enhancing another problem.
Well, thank you for calling, Ariane. That is Mark Jacobson. He's professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford. He's co-founder of the Solutions Project, which is calling for a transition to 100% clean, renewable energy. Mark Shapiro is a longtime environmental journalist and author of Carbon Shock, a tale of risk and calculus on the front lines of a disrupted global economy. And today we are talking about the decision coming out of the Paris Climate Summit. It's a landmark deal because for the first time, 195 countries have agreed to limit the rise in global temperatures to less than 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And a lot of environmentalists say this is an amazing deal. A lot of others say it doesn't go far enough. And so what questions do you have about this? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Melissa in El Cerrito. Hi, Melissa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the definition of just transition. I think it's a bigger concept than was mentioned than just providing assistance to folks who are in the current paradigm jobs to new jobs. It really is about ensuring or making sure that the people that least contributed to the problem, the poor, the, quote, undeveloped countries, are not the people and the countries that pay for this, and that's what's currently going on.
Right.
So I think that's really important to understand, that it's about creating an economy that doesn't perpetuate the inequalities built into the current economy.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to get there. So the deal also calls for $100 billion a year in climate financing from wealthy countries for developing countries by 2020. And Mark Shapiro, I mean, this has been an issue at all the climate talks. The poor countries are saying, and rightly so, we are not the ones that are emitting the greenhouse gases, but we're the ones who are being devastated by climate change. So the Maldives often gets attention. According to reports, 70% of the Maldives will be underwater by the end of the century. What changed? Did poor countries have a bigger voice at the table this time?
I think that the first of all, thank you for your clarification on the just transition. Yes, I was focusing on the United States, but of course, what you've identified is exactly correct. That is fundamental to this agreement. And I think what's changed is that there is acknowledgement that the impacts of climate change are happening already. I mean, this is it. This is, you know, it was very interesting. I was part of what I was doing in Paris was working with the Internews Environmental Journalism Network, which brought 20 journalists from different developing countries over to Paris to report on the talks for their home newspapers. And so I worked with Latin Americans and Africans who were working with some of the biggest newspapers back home and were given fellowships by this organization. What was most interesting was to realize that here in the United States, we talk about, you need a narrative to talk about climate change. How are you going to, like, create a victim? How are you going to, this is maybe inside journalistic talk, but how are you going to write about climate change? I'm sure you face it here at KLW. How do we do this to make it meaningful to Americans? Well, that kind of question never occurred to the people that I was working with. And I worked very closely with, for example, Africans from the largest paper in Nigeria, the largest paper in Ghana, some of the largest papers in South Africa. None of whom were concerned about the notion of how do I get people interested in this topic back home, because they are living through it. Mm-hmm. And, for example, in Ghana, the biggest river in Ghana has been going through a drought, just like we have here in the United States, in California. What does a drought mean in Ghana? Well, what it means is that the major river that supplies a dam, which supplies the electricity for most of the capital city of Accra, has been drying up, which means that they get sporadic supplies of electricity in the capital city because of the drought. Now, we have not yet experienced that here in the United States, broadly speaking. We have many other consequences of the drought. But to get a picture of the huge discrepancy between what the impacts of climate change are in a country that does not have the resources to deal with it is this enormous gap.
Right.
And this was recognized really to a high degree with this kind of $100 billion a year. And there are as yet no legal mechanisms to compel that amount of money, but there seems to be some kind of something resembling a good faith effort to come up with that.
All right. Well, that's really important. That could also be another show. So thank you for bringing that up. We're almost out of time. Ruthann, we don't have time to take your call, but I'll ask your question. And that is, what about cuts in subsidies to agriculture? Paul Watson, the founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, they protect sharks and whales in the ocean, really amazing activist. He was in Paris, and he said that he was really disappointed because animal agriculture was not on the table at all. In fact, he said, as a vegetarian, you couldn't even find food. It was all meat-based. And I just want to ask both of you about this, because we're talking about deforestation. An estimated 70% of deforestation in the Amazon basin can be attributed to cattle ranching. And then animal agriculture is responsible for 18% of greenhouse gas emissions, more than the combined exhaust from all transportation. And this is according to the FAO.org. This is a government group, I believe. I'll get the right name of this. But what about that, Mark Shapiro? Why wasn't animal ag talked about at all? Because we're talking about the causes of climate change at this conference, right?
Yes. And first of all, I mean, some of the most powerful countries have extremely significant animal livestock industries, including Brazil and Argentina, as well as the United States.
Right.
It's not only the United States. It's certainly Brazil, Argentina, and other countries, which sort of mitigated against, you know, highlighting this issue. I do think it was dealt somewhat in the kind of land use provisions, and maybe Dr. Jacobson has an observation on that. I think there's no question, quickly, that meat is the largest footprint when it comes to food and has to be dealt with on some level to reduce consumption.
And the FAO is the Food and Agriculture Organization for the UN. I just wanted to make sure I got that right. Mark Jacobson, what are your thoughts on Big Ag and why it was mostly missing from the conference?
Well, I mean, if you look at the emissions from agriculture, most of them are from the permanent deforestation. Then the second largest would be from the fossil fuel use that goes into agriculture, into fertilizing, to cultivating, to processing. And then the third is kind of just the emissions from cows themselves, just belching cows, the methane coming out of them. So we can actually address the first two before people even address their eating habits through reducing deforestation and through in changing the fossil fuel infrastructure. And there are ways to actually capture some of the methane from cows themselves, although it's probably not going to take on too much. But certainly then reducing meat intake is a push that's going on and would certainly benefit. But if you assume that people aren't going to change their habits, then we can still reduce quite a bit of the emissions through other mechanisms. But then to get the rest of it, to get the remaining amount, we'd have to have people change their habits, and that's going to be a social issue.
And this is getting a lot more attention in the media, I've got to say, over the last couple of years. Final thoughts, Mark Shapiro, as a journalist and someone who follows these issues so closely, what are you looking at next? What is the time frame here? Because the agreement itself is legally binding, but the pledges to curb emissions and the climate finance elements are not. So what's next?
All right. What's next is the transformation that happens over time as this economy sort of begins to grind in a new direction. And journalistically, where there's change, there's tension. And when there's tension, there's interests that battle over kind of the nature of that change. And so journalistically, there's an enormous amount to look into, to probe, to monitor the political, economic, technological, legal shifts that are basically underway as we speak.
And just quickly, behind the scenes, I have heard that the Obama administration made sure that they will be able to abide by these voluntary rules or this new pact, even when you're hearing from Republicans who say this doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, yes. He figured out how to do it without going to Congress.
Okay. Wanted to get that out there. Mark Shapiro is a longtime environmental journalist and author of Carbon Shock. Mark Jacobson is professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford and co-founder of the Solutions Project, a nonprofit whose mission is to transition to 100% renewable clean energy. Mark and Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll talk about this year's best documentaries. We've done many shows about films focusing on the rise of the Black Panther Party, the lives of recyclers in West Oakland, and the murder of Jordan Davis, a Black teenager who was playing loud music in a gas station parking lot in Jacksonville, Florida. Which documentary stood out for you this year? Which ones inspired you to act? Email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org, and join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.